by Krosik and
Kaczynska.
Kaczynska, thank you, John. Called Understanding the Value of Art and Culture. And he will also look at how academics and other work on the value of culture has influenced both policy and practice. So please join me in welcoming John.
Hello, good morning, everybody. Sarah just mentioned this publication that's come out very recently. It's an enormously thick thing by Jeff Krosik, who's been awarded of Goldsmiths, and Patricia Kaczynska, who I knew when she was an intern at Demos, the think tank where I used to work. And it has such a lot to say about the value of culture and methodologies behind it, evidence, all this kind of thing. I'll refer to it a bit later. But this has been published in the gap between when Sarah asked me to speak and today. And it's something that I think all of you should go onto the internet and download and find, because it really is a summation of so much work that has gone before and takes us onto a whole new level in our understanding, I think, of the value of culture. I was involved in that as an advisory board member, and I was also involved with this thing, which I'd also recommend to you, Cultural Capital by Robert Hewison, someone who I've co-authored a number of things with. And this is like a history of cultural policy from the Blair years and beyond, up to date. And it's quite an entertaining look at what went on with things like the Millennium Dome and the Olympics and so forth. And it teaches you an awful lot about policy and practice and politics and how they all intertwine in practice rather than in theory, because there's a big difference between the two, I think. So, given that those two things have been published fairly recently, I don't want to just kind of tell you what's in them. I thought I'd make today a bit more of a personal story about how I've seen impact, debate, develop in this area around cultural value over the last 15 years or so. So I'll talk about some of what I've been doing, some of my own work in there. But I thought a good place to start would be to think about a little bit about how policy and practice evolve. What you're trying to do, or what we are all trying to do as academics or researchers or writers, is to make changes within the world. And there's a sort of model in people's heads that you talk to politicians who then make legislative or administrative change, and that filters down through the system, and the people underground then act, they change the way that they do things, and the result is the world improves. So, to take an example, like in the health service, you have an academic who sees that washing your hands improves the rate of reinfection. They tell the politicians about it, they legislate that everybody in the NHS has to wash their hands, and notice goes up on every tap, bingo, 20% fewer patients die within 3 months, or whatever. So this kind of linear change from research to practice to outcome. But if you look at the world of the arts and culture, it's a bit kind of messier than that for many, many reasons. And because, I'll explain why in a minute, but because of that, you might want to think about where the best points of leverage are within a system. So if you want to make some change in the world, it's the best thing to try and influence public opinion, so that we have a public that appreciates, let's say, the public funding of culture and the public realm against neoliberal arguments that the state shouldn't intervene in this area. So do we want to appeal to the public? Do we want to talk specifically to the Secretary of State for Culture about introducing some very specific change that we have in mind that we think would be good? Do we want to talk to particular experts, let's say, you know, museum directors or theatre producers or whatever, because that is the point where you're going to be most effective. So you've got to think through the best point of leverage within the overall cultural system if change is your aim. So why did I say that it's a bit different in arts and culture? Well, if you think about the post-war relationship between our sector, arts and culture, and government, it's been different to something like transport or defence or the health service or all those things. They have had ministries all the way through, manned by very large numbers of civil servants, and policy has generally often been made within government. And you've had pressure from outside, from, say, corporations or charities or whatever. So it's not that there isn't pressure and advocacy coming from outside, but very often policy formulation has been within the government machinery. That's less true in the arts, because until 1992, we didn't even have a ministry. That's when the Department for National Heritage was set up. And it got real flat in 1997 when it became the Department for Culture, Media and Sport. So before that, whoever in government, the Minister for Culture, the various bits of government that dealt with culture, whether they were the Education Ministry or the Commission for Museums or whatever, they didn't have that bedrock of civil service knowledge and tradition and expertise on which to rely to such a great degree. So what happened was that a symbiotic relationship grew up between government and some outsiders. That was principally at that time foundations. And you can look especially at the history of the Gulbenkian Foundation, which government often asked to address particular cultural issues and come back with reports on them. Or sometimes the Gulbenkian would know, because of its relationship with practitioners, that an issue needed to be addressed, and it would commission some work and then present that to government. And government would be very receptive because they had this pretty close and trusting relationship. So in the 1970s, for example, you get a whole series of things coming out from the Gulbenkian that operate sometimes in subtly different ways. So in 1976, for example, there was something called the Redcliffe-Maud report that looked at the arts in the regions. Well, Redcliffe-Maud was this kind of great and good figure sitting in the House of Lords, immense experience within government, and asked by the Gulbenkian to put together a commission and to talk to people, to gather opinion, and then to make recommendations, which then fed directly into government agency policies. In the same year, 1976, you had a report from the Gulbenkian written by Nassim Khan called The Arts Britain Ignores. Again, a pressing issue about why ethnic minority arts were not funded properly in this country, and that influenced practice and policy development as well. And there's a whole chain of them going through the 70s, through the 60s, the arts in schools, Gulbenkian providing an education officer to the art, funding the first ever education officer within the Arts Council. In the 1980s, it becomes a bit more different, because then you have ministries within government and a civil service, and the Gulbenkian shifts to responding more to government priorities and ideologies. So in the late 1980s, 88, the Gulbenkian commissions a report from John Myerscough called The Economic Importance of the Arts. And this is really responding to the Thatcher government's agenda that the arts have to be businesslike, and they are essentially the handmaiden of business. They are there to make money, to create jobs, to regenerate, and so forth. So you're now getting a response from the foundation rather than a symbiotic relationship with government. That continues in the 90s with the report from François Matarassa called Use or Ornament, which is responding to the Labour government's idea that culture can be used for its social impacts. The way that it can help with education outcomes, health outcomes, prisons, a whole list of social policy priorities that the government then had. But it's not just the Gulbenkian. Governments also worked with other trusts and foundations over the years, perhaps most recently the CLAW with the leadership programme. Government had tried and looked at leadership issues for a long, long time and really not tackled it very effectively through the DCMS.
and this law came along and essentially created one among other solutions to that. So, you've got the civil service, you've got NGOs and foundations plugging into policy impact. You've then got think tanks, where I spent years working inside Demos. And think tanks are quite interesting places, because what they try to do is combine a degree of academic rigour, and they very often draw on academic partners, but they want also to get media impact and get and sway public opinion, and also to influence politics and politicians. So they're interested in getting into all of those different spaces. And their value, I think, lies in being able to translate across those places and to bring different kinds of people into the same room who might normally never sit together and debate together. So what think tanks bring to all this, I think, primarily is they produce work which is written in a language which almost anyone can understand. It's of a brevity that most people can cope with. And it has reach because of the way that they interact with the media and their particular relationship with politics. Reach, is really, really important. I might just pause to tell you a little story about Demos. Because traditionally, think tanks produced pamphlets, about 100 pages long maximum, often shorter than that, and they'd print about 1,000 of them and give them away to people. And they would attempt to influence debate by getting those pamphlets to the right people, whether to MPs or experts in the field or whatever. In 2003, we were having a cup of coffee at Demos one morning, just sitting around talking about what we thought Demos was. And the first response to that question of what is Demos was, it's the staff here. It's the people who write the stuff. That's who really Demos is. And then someone said, well, no, it's more than that. It's all the past staff, and it's the interns. We can possibly run this place without interns. So instead of thinking of us as a group of 15 to 20 people, we should be thinking of ourselves as a group of about 50 or 100 people. And somebody said, well, that's an inadequate answer, because we've got a database with 5,000 names on it of people who we're in touch with, who we send stuff out to, and who are interested in our work. So it's not 20 people, it's 5,000 people. And then something really interesting happened. A woman walked into the room, and she put a map of the world on the table. And she said, a month ago, I bought a small piece of software that told me where all the hits on our website were coming from. And do you know, in the past 4 weeks, we've had hits from Russia, Australia, the Turks and Caicos Islands, Romania, Italy, Australia, New Zealand, so on and so on and so on. And suddenly we realised that in the world of the internet, and it's so recent, but it was radically different back then, it's quite extraordinary. In the world of the internet, we were no longer 20 people sitting in a room or 5,000 people connected by a postal service. We were potentially as big as the number of people who wanted to join in, who were interested in our work. And not only did we have to have a channel to get that work out, we actually had an interface with people to shape research agendas, to bring in expertise from all over the globe. And what that did was we instantly changed our business model so that we didn't simply produce 1,000 pamphlets anymore and put them in the post and make sure that they were read by the Secretary of State for this, that, or the other. We put them free as PDFs on the web. The first one we did, the traditional way, 1,000 pamphlet way, would have been read by about 1,000 people. The first one had 85,000 downloads from all over the world, principally Europe, because it was about migration in Europe. It
topic. So it just transformed our reach. And that was an absolutely huge, huge step in influencing public opinion. So something which seemed quite small at the time actually turned into something absolutely enormous. So think tanks, reach, media, language, and length. The next party to this is academia, of course. Very, very different to think tanks. Think tanks tend to be underfunded. They do very short-term projects, which are often poorly resourced. Academia, by contrast, has not always, but often the luxury of length of time and more money. And this project, for example, had a £2 million budget and 3 years in which to do it. When I wrote my first pamphlet on cultural value, nobody would fund it, so I wrote it in my weekends and evenings, because it was an unfundable proposition. Why would anybody be interested in ideas? No. So there's a huge difference between the think tank world and academia. I remember once, a few years ago, we worked with a university on a project, and at the first meeting, we sat down and said, what do we think this project needs to address this issue? And in the think tank, we said, we reckon this needs a budget of about £30,000, and we could probably do it in 3 months at a pinch. 4 months would be better. And the university partners separately had come up with, we need 3 years, six researchers, and a budget of £400,000. So radically, radically different kind of approaches. Both valid in their own ways, and actually turned out into a really, really good partnership, bringing these two things together. But they are quite different in the way that they work. So I think academia can produce really, really great work like this. Equally, it can go wrong. I've seen several projects where academics have applied for research grants for a particular topic and then decided that something was actually much more interesting, so they'll take the project over here and they will produce something quite different to the thing that they thought they were originally going to produce. And you know, academic freedom, all that's fine. But in a think tank you could never do that, because you're accountable to somebody. You've got some client breathing down your neck the whole time. So academia does great work. The next one, which might surprise you, is public relations companies. Not much talked about in this area, but actually public relations companies often act as interesting connectors in the system, because they know the politicians, they know the practitioners, and these days they're not just like people who put on an event at the end of the process. They're actually making things happen, putting ideas into the system. So they can drive agendas as well. And then finally, there's journalism, which the other parties use, think tankers use, academics use, but also obviously there are pure journalists themselves writing about these things. So you've got all those different players in the arts and cultural world attempting to influence what goes on in terms of both policy and practice and the politics of it as well. I think interestingly, over the recent past, you've also got hybrids emerging. Things like Nesta, which is independent, but has its own funding source, is close to government but not part of government, is close to academia but not part of academia. You had the Warwick Commission inquiry into cultural value, which was located in an academic institution, but actually brought in lots of practitioners and people from outside to inform what was going on, to take evidence from, and then in the end also to disseminate the messages through journalism and so forth.
So you've got all kinds of hybrids now happening between academia, the outside world, practitioners, politics, and so on. You also, I think, at the moment have less ability to influence government than was the case from 1997 to 2010. I think of that era as being an era of real opportunity for think tanks in particular, because government was very open to those kinds of ideas coming in from outside. When governments are more closed, they know what they want, they also have fewer resources, they tend to get more enclosed and less receptive to those kinds of influences. The third thing in the current situation is, I think, there's some kind of denigration of the idea of advocacy. And it comes up in the AHRC's Cultural Value Report. One of the things they say there is, previous debate about cultural value has been distorted by the desire to protect public funding and to influence policy. The AHRC took on this project not to advocate its own cause or to speak on behalf of cultural institutions, but to fulfil its role as a research council. Well, I'm not entirely convinced by either of those arguments. I think whenever you produce something like that, part of the thing is saying, we're good at this, and fair enough. You know, if you are good at it, then there is a case for saying so. But I don't see why advocacy should be thought of as distorting policy. It can influence policy, but it influences policy to the good. And very often policy is formed not simply by evidence, but by all sorts of ideological arguments that are made. So if you believe, as I passionately do, that public funding is good, that's not something that I can really prove to a non-believer through statistics and data. It's something that I have to argue passionately for in many, many different kinds of ways. And I think that kind of advocacy is perfectly valid. So we shouldn't think that academia occupies some sort of area of pure research over here and everybody else is involved in the grubby business of trying to get their own way by somehow surreptitiously undermining democratic political processes. I don't think that's how it works at all in practice. So I think we need to be aware of people's agendas the whole time, but we shouldn't denigrate the role of advocacy in the formation of policy or in changing practice. Okay, right. So I wanted to turn specifically then to cultural value and the cultural value debate. I first got involved in it in a rather odd way. This is going back to 2002. I was chairing the board of an arts organisation in the town where I live, which is based down in Hampshire. And one day we had a call from a local authority arts officer to say that they were going to give us a grant of £20,000. And we were absolutely delighted because we'd been talking to them for, I think, 3 years at that point trying to get a grant, so this was wonderful. And they said, but we haven't got any money in the arts budget, so this money is going to come from the education budget. And we said, that's fine, we do plenty of education work, we can use the money that you give us specifically for that, that's not a problem. And then they said, and we have an educational priority this year concerning road safety for school children. And at that point, we as a board kind of scratched our heads and said, well, you know, we're all in favour of road safety for school children. Okay, what's wrong? But we are a live music venue. Our strap line is Great Music Live. Why are we being asked to do something for this kind of agenda? It seemed really odd to us. And actually, we turned the money down and said, you know, it should be offered on a more sensible and frankly honest way, because everybody could have conspired to take the money and do something different with it, but we weren't prepared to do that. We thought if we're going to use it for the arts, then it should be used for the arts quite openly. So I had this rather odd
experience, and didn't know quite what to do with it. But then there was an article in The Observer written by Nicholas Heitner, who was running the National Theatre at the time. And the headline above the article was, "To Hell with Targets." And what Nick Heitner was saying there, he didn't actually invent the headline, that was done by a sub-editor. But what he was saying in that article was that he wanted to be judged as a theatre director on the work that he put on stage. He didn't want to be burdened with a massive amount of targets that were about economic things, about audiences, that were about this, that and the other. He felt that government policy was going wrong in this area, and that arts were being asked to do too much. It's true that for a long while, government had been increasingly micromanaging and putting targets on absolutely everything that moved. Not just in the cultural sector, absolutely across the board, but certainly within the cultural sector. In 2002, for example, the National Maritime Museum had within its agreement with government a clause which said that it had to reduce its use of photocopier paper by 300 reams every year. So that's the type of micromanagement that was going on. People had extraordinarily detailed targets to hit. The Edinburgh Festival had that year 78 targets given to it by Edinburgh Council, which it had. And of course, in reality, targets were hit, targets were missed, some were slipped, some weren't counted properly, some this and that. It was all getting to be too much. The next thing that happened was I was invited to a meeting by Charles Somerville Smith at the National Gallery. He was the director of the National Gallery at the time. And in the room, there was me, Charles, Nick Starr from the National Theatre, an extremely wise and good cultural consultant called Adrian Ellis, and Robert Hewison. And we talked over this issue of government micromanagement by target. And we decided that something really needed to be done. And what we decided to do was put on a Demos conference where we could bring interested parties together to talk about this issue. What we didn't know at the time was that actually the people within the DCMS were equally exercised by this. They were being given targets by the Treasury, and then they had to downstream them to the Arts Council, and the Arts Council had to downstream them to arts organisations. They were equally unhappy. And we got a call from Tessa Jowell's office saying she would like to speak. So she came along to the conference. Estelle Morris, her first day as Minister for the Arts, came along to the conference. And we had exactly 100 people around tables, exactly like you're sitting today. And it was a very powerful and extraordinary meeting that had major outcomes, I think. One thing that happened as a result of it was that government sort of put its hands up and said, yeah, we know we've got a problem. We don't actually like micromanaging to this degree. And Tessa Jowell, the Secretary of State for Culture, wrote a personal essay called Government and the Value of Culture. And in it, she posed a question. She said, how in going beyond targets can we best capture the value of culture? And I read that and I thought, well, you know, that's a very interesting question, Tessa. That's a very interesting question. She didn't answer it in her pamphlet, so I thought, well, I'll have a go at answering it. So, as I say, in my evenings off and weekends, I thought, I'll just try and figure this out from first base. What is the value of culture to society? How can we talk about it? The first thing that struck me was that it wasn't the only place, the only discipline, if you like, that was having trouble talking about things that it knew was important but found very, very difficult to express. So we in the arts, we knew that theatre mattered, that dance mattered, that museums were important, that heritage was important, but we were finding it very difficult to develop a language to express it.
But people in the environmental movement were in exactly the same boat. Nature is important, our environment is important, clean air is important, but how do we talk about it, how do we express it? Particularly in the face of government and business and systems that constantly demand hard data and evidence. Where do you provide the hard data for a numinous spiritual experience? How do you put the figure of pounds, shillings and pence on an existential cry of loneliness in the face of the meaningless universe? You know, all those questions. What do you do? So that's what I decided to do. So I went out and I read lots of work, principally by David Throsby, a cultural economist in Australia, who was doing some interesting work on this at the time, and also another guy called Mark Moore from Harvard, who was doing work on public value and the role of public institutions in the creation of the public realm. So those were two major influences. So I wrote this thing called Capturing Cultural Value, and then about a year later, something called Cultural Value and the Crisis of Legitimacy, where I think I started making a bit of progress in that one. And there were four...
How long have I got? Sorry. When am I about to finish?
15 minutes.
15 minutes, right, okay. There were four propositions that I really wanted to put forward about cultural value. They were these. First was the idea that value is not the same for everybody. There are certain things that you can measure objectively, but value is not really one of them. Value is something that I place on an experience, an event, or whatever. So it's subjective. And people are going to have different ideas about what value is. So that's the first proposition. The second proposition was that value and benefit are two different things. And they need to be talked about, measured, evidenced in different ways. The third proposition I wanted to do was to get away from the debate about intrinsic value versus instrumental value. I'll talk about those in a second. But essentially, at this point in history, these two things were thought to be in opposition, intrinsic value and instrumental value, and I thought we needed to find a way out of that dilemma, even though it had been going on for at least 2,500 years. And then the fourth thing I wanted to say was that value and the benefits as well, particularly value, is not a fixed and eternal thing, that it's shifting. Cultural artifacts are relative in their emotional and financial value changes. So there's nothing fixed in what we're talking about here. Very good example of this is Landseer and Van Gogh. Landseer, on the left, used to be the most valued, financially and probably emotionally and spiritually as well, artist. The 1890s, Van Gogh, as we all know, died in poverty and near madness, unable to sell a picture. The assessment of those two works of art is completely turned around. So if you have somebody ever tries to assert that there are fundamental ideas about beauty, aesthetics, that are unchanging over time, just point them in the direction of these two things, which I think clinch the arguments. So those are the kind of four propositions that I wanted to put forward. And I did it by creating a framework that looked at three types of value rather than two types of value. The first one was intrinsic value. The word intrinsic was used to mean several different things. The first thing it meant was of the essence, the irreducible core. So dance is dance, poetry is poetry, music is music. And we need those forms of human expression in order to be human beings, really. So that's kind of irreducible meaning of intrinsic. But intrinsic was also being used as a proxy for individual and subjective reactions to culture. All those emotional, spiritual, intellectual engagements that we have with it. It's intangible and it's very, very difficult to measure. Quite difficult to talk about very often. we all know the difficulty in telling a friend about why we like a particular piece of music, and we find that they don't. How do we talk about that? It's really, really hard. But we know that this type of value, our emotional and intellectual responses to things, can be improved and increased through preparatory work and what we bring to it in the first place. So that was one type of value that I identified. The second was instrumental value. And this goes back to what I was talking about before, the role of the arts in achieving economic and social goals. This is quite a different kind of value, and in retrospect I wish I called this benefit, not value. Because here you're talking about something that is objective, it is measurable. There are all sorts of problems with measurement, you know, the advocacy versus research thing, cause in it, what is a cause, what's a correlation, how do we know that one group of people will react in the same way as another group of people, how do we know that the £5 that we spent on an arts experience wouldn't have been better spent on something else, you know. So many questions, all of them addressed in the Crossick paper. But still, the idea here is that these are types of benefit which are, at least in theory, measurable and objective. So a different kind of value to intrinsic value. Then to get away from the idea of those two things being in opposition to each other, when in fact they can only ever exist together, I created this idea of institutional value, which drew heavily on public value discourse, which was about the social role of the arts and the way in which arts organisations can themselves act to increase or decrease public goods. Because it was my contention that arts organisations and museums and so forth were places where the public engaged with the public realm of their own volition. Almost everywhere where you come into contact with the public sector, you are not doing so of your own free will. So you think about courts, you think about hospitals, you think about schools, you are compelled by necessity or legislation to have a relationship with those. You're not compelled to go to the theatre or to step through the doors of the museum. So this seems to me a very interesting part of the public world. Politicians should be very interested in, because it's a place where the public freely. And consequently, the way in which those organisations act, the way they help people get a sense of the society and the community that they live in, the way they help them learn, the way they help them socialise, the way they are treated, that all is a really important way in which we come together. So I thought that this idea of the value of institutions and organisations was quite an important one to bring into the frame. I then thought, going back to that thing about everybody has a different idea about value, I thought, well, there are three main constituencies involved here who will have a different idea of value. First of all, you've got the public. Lots and lots of different types of people, but kind of non-experts in the field who are engaging with culture in all kinds of different ways. Politicians who not only provide the money for the publicly funded sector, but also set the terms of legislation on censorship, for example, or the agenda of the arts in schools. They influence the arts in all sorts of ways. And then you have the professionals and practitioners who are delivering the stuff and making it happen. So I thought, well, you put those two things together, these ideas of value and these ideas of people who do the valuing, and what do you find? You find a discrepancy. Because the public, surely, are principally interested in intrinsic value. If you or I go to a show, we don't sit there thinking, oh gosh, I'm really glad that this is contributing to business prosperity and regional development in South Yorkshire, do you? You think, oh, that's good, I'm enjoying this, you know, I want to have a good time. So you're principally interested in what's going on? Is it moving? Can I stop moving on there? Yeah. I've gone the wrong way. There we go, sorry.
So they, the public's principally interested in intrinsic value. Politicians, by contrast, they aren't particularly interested in whether I'm sitting in there in Romeo and Juliet having a good time or not. They want to know that the way that they spend money is having some kind of impact on society in pursuing their goals. So they are interested in big outcomes for large numbers of people. So they want data about it. They want evidence about it. They want to know if they spend more money, then it'll have an even bigger effect. They want predictability about all this in a sphere which is inherently unpredictable. So there's immediately a kind of disparity here. The professionals, well, they've got to be interested in the intrinsic stuff. Otherwise, why would they be following? They get interested in this because they're having to fill in lots of forms for the politicians to get the money to do what they want to do in the first place. But they're pretty cross about it because they don't know why they're having to fill in the forms, and they resent it enormously. So the whole system gets incredibly dysfunctional. If they're running their organisations well, then they should be thinking about that too, about the public that they serve, because it's the public that's ultimately providing them with the wherewithal to do what they want to do. So I detected within this a kind of huge potential for misunderstanding, argument, and unhappiness. And I think it's pretty clearly evidenced by what goes on, that the system it does not function entirely well. My answer to that was to say to the professionals, well, you know, you concentrate on trying to talk to the politicians about the value of culture in its instrumental terms. You spend your days proving to them that it is socially and economically beneficial. But what you should be doing is having a much closer dialogue and a much better relationship with your public. Because ultimately, it's the public to appoint politicians. And if you have a fantastically good relationship through this kind of value and this kind of value with those people, it's going to influence those people to take the right decisions. So there is a way of getting away from this target-driven micromanagement agenda around cultural value by going in a different direction. That was ultimately the argument of that paper. And I think it did have a bit of effect, but I'll spend the last 5 minutes just talking about what I think the effect of all this has been. Going back to where I started, really, about this, the whole idea of impact. What does have impact and what doesn't have impact? In my experience, it's very, very hard to predict exactly what is going to have impact and what is not. Sometimes you get things picked up that you're surprised by, and other times things just go into the ether. What does get picked up? What good do all these reports do? Well, one thing is that if you get a lot going on at the same time, you can create a climate of opinion around an issue, so that people are aware that it's a concern, and they start thinking more about solutions to it. So, this whole business of targets and micromanagement wasn't just us in Demos. Policy Exchange was producing work on the stuff. Other people were producing work on the stuff. It created a broad climate of opinion to say we need to do something about this. The second thing you can do is you can find yourself playing into a situation that is receptive. And the best example I've got of this is that a few years after all this value and culture stuff, I read something about cultural diplomacy. It's called Cultural Diplomacy. And it was looking at culture and international relations, specifically at the role of museums in that. Fairly specialist topic, I thought, until I got a call from the Today programme to go and be interviewed about it and invited all over the world to go and talk about it. And I figured out in retrospect that pamphlet had had such a big influence because of the moment that it was produced. The moment that it was produced was a time when the Iraq war was going horribly wrong. There was an enormous cost financially and, more importantly, in human lives. And people were, even if not consciously, thinking, what do we do? What, there's got to be a better way than this. And that whole cultural diplomacy thing played into a moment of opportunity to open up and say, yeah, there is another way that we can go about this. We can try to understand each other better through culture. So there's that. The next thing is that you can get killer stats and phrases that you plonk into the debate, and then you see them coming back at you, and you know that you've made a difference. You had some influence. I'll quote you one, nothing to do with me, but it's a very famous one, which is, the creative industries are growing at twice the rate of the rest of the economy. Everybody knows that about the creative industries. Where does it come from? An obscure report done for the Southeast Economic Development Agency. In its original form, it appears with lots of caveats. Although we say this, four paragraphs of explanation about it. But the phrase gets picked up, gets repeated at conferences, it goes into political speeches, and it becomes a truth. It becomes a reality. And because of that, there's more investment in the creative industries than the creative industries ever do. Double it, twice the rest of the economy. So you can use particular phrases, particular statistics that seem to resonate and bring about very specific changes in the debate. But mostly, I think the impact is quite limited. I've found with impact, you go two steps forward, one step back. That cultural diplomacy thing, there was a huge amount of interest in it right off the bat, and then nobody knew what to do with it. There was, some money went to a consortium of museums, but then, like, the journalistic thing moved on, and where has it gone? Not hardly anywhere, really, I think. So, if you are trying to change the world for the better, I'd say it's a long, hard road. It's worth doing. Sometimes you have minor victories, which you should definitely celebrate. Sometimes it's quite depressing. But it's good work, so do it. All right, thank you.